Well, here we are. We're coming to the text that, for many of us, might be the only text that we are typically familiar with as one of the direct passages on homosexuality in the Bible. We've been at this a number of weeks now, 6 or 7 weeks, trying to summarize and apply the biblical teaching on the subject of homosexuality. And that takes us to some kind of unfamiliar parts of the Bible, and sort of inevitable that we're going to get to Romans 1, which is kind of the famous passage, the longest and most direct passage anyways about the subject. But the amazing thing about this passage is that it actually isn't directly about homosexuality. We find this in Scripture, that God is determined that we not focus on issues of what's technically right and wrong, apart from the larger issue of our relationship to Him and what it means to be made in His image and to be His creature, and all these other big, big issues. And it's actually as a case study in the larger issue of fallen humanity's relationship to a holy Creator that Paul gives this very direct teaching about homosexuality. So, yes, homosexuality is one of the topics in this passage, but it's not the only topic, nor the most important topic in a way, because it arises as a case study in the history of human sin and divine judgment. That's the way we have to realize Paul is teaching us here. He's getting at the whole issue of the history of human sin and divine judgment, and homosexuality comes up as a case study, an especially good example of the things that he's talking about on a larger scale. That larger teaching of the apostle falls into four steps. And it starts off with this statement that the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. That's probably a reference to the fact that the apostles are going around teaching the gospel, starting off with the truth that there is wrath stored up from heaven against sinners. People weren't aware of that. Few were in ancient Greece or ancient Iran or India or Spain, and you were just going about your daily life. The gods had a big role in your life. Gods for farming, gods for family, God for this, God for that. But the idea that in a general way, God, the Creator, was angry with humans because of sin was not sufficiently appreciated by people. The gods were small, and their wrath was small too, even though they were very cruel and wrathful gods. So part of the apostolic message in the mission work of Paul and others was to proclaim this truth, that God is angry at sinners. But then the immediate question that comes up, and the first step of Paul's analysis here, is, well, how could God be angry with sinners? Isn't that a little unfair? People in Spain and Greece and Libya and Iran and India, they never heard about God. How could the apostles go around telling everybody God's angry? And here we come, as I say, to the first step of Paul's history of human sin and divine judgment, which is that God has revealed himself in creation to all humanity. There's very strong words here about how much people do know about God. Verse 19, what can be known about God is plain to them. Plain to them. Have you ever appreciated the significance of that statement? What can be known about God is plain. It's relatively obvious. Why? Because God has shown it to them. See, we tend to think about people who are outside the preaching of the gospel as being fogged in obscurity and darkness because creation has nothing to tell them about God that's very clear at all. And what little they can learn about God is derived only from their own effort. And the really smart ones will be able to get a bit of knowledge about God, but everybody else is really hopeless. But it's saying here, it's not that humans are smart enough to look at nature and find some truth about God. It's saying that God has shown it to them that way. Okay? We all know a lot about God just from creation. And then the question is, okay, so people know God, but really how is that possible without the Bible and other types of more specific and direct revelation, you know, prophets and apostles and the scriptures? Well, the answer to that question is in verse 20. Look at, first of all the things that God thinks the world should know about him from creation. His invisible attributes. Now, if you ask somebody, like, over there in the parking lot of Safeway, do you believe that God has invisible attributes? They'll probably not know what you're talking about, right? But Paul is teaching that at root, all of us do know that there is invisible reality bigger and beyond this world. And we should be able to think about the fact that, you know, the grass we're standing on, the turf that we're standing on, that couldn't be there just on its own. It must be someone or something out there that's so big and so powerful that he's beyond the limits of visible created reality. That's the type of thing we should be able to figure out from creation. Invisible attributes. His power, his ability to create things, his eternality. That's another thing we should be able to tell about God from the creation. And his divine nature. We should be able to tell that he's not one of the creatures. This is pretty amazing. I mean, it's a lot of information about God that God has shown to us and is plain to us because of the way God created. And then you say, well, how is it clear? And it says here, in the things that have been made. In other words, our physical eyes look at physical things and learn about invisible things by looking at visible things. Okay? So we look at the sun or the stars, and our physical eyes are looking at them, but we have an ability as humans made in God's image to think about what we're seeing and learn about invisible realities by looking at visible realities. That's what we know about God. God has clearly shown himself in creation. And what that means, there's sort of two implications here. One is that everybody has enough information from creation to know that there is a creator who is a good and kind and admirable being. Okay? Now, there's a lot that we couldn't get from creation. Nobody's going to be able to write a big theology book based on just what they learned from creation, get everything right, and include things like the Trinity and the Incarnation and all sorts of things that are surprises to us about God. But everybody should be able, every single human being in the world, at some level, should be able to come to the conclusion that this world exists because of an uncreated God who is good, wise, and powerful, and therefore deserves our worship. And that's the second implication. I must worship and obey that God is something that everybody in the world should be able to conclude. But this is, it almost sounds fantastic or unbelievable that Paul would say this, right? Because you look around the world and you don't see this happening. You don't see people instinctively, naturally, basically getting the main parts about who God is right and then trying to worship and obey him faithfully. I mean, you just don't see that. The work of missions is not going to people who are really doing their best and really succeeding in some limited way at being Christians and just filling in blanks that they still have. The work of missions would be a lot easier if that's what it was. The work of missions is something much bigger because of a second step that Paul talks about in the history of human sin and divine judgment. And that is that even though we know all this about God, we humans have decided not to know him, acknowledge him, worship him, or obey him. That's the second thing Paul says. We refused to honor him, verse 21. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Okay? Although they knew him, they did not honor him. That's human sin right there. This is also stated up in verse 18, where is a good translation in the ESV here that I'm using. It says that we suppress the truth. What that means is people have the truth, but they are deliberately and willfully refusing to live in it. Okay? There's a difference between not having the truth by sheer and simple ignorance and suppressing the truth that you do have deliberately. And that's the situation that Paul says we're in because of sin. But something that still happens among humans, though, is the fact and reality and activity of worship. It's not like we stopped worshiping at all. What we did is instead of worshiping God, even though we knew him, we decided to continue worshiping, but to worship other things that we've made. And this is the really sad thing about human history. It's recorded in a very pungent way in verse 21. They became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. And what did they do? What was the proof of their foolishness and darkness of heart? They exchanged, verse 23, the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. So just think of how foolish this is. We look at ourselves and we ought to be able to grasp some of the meaning of Genesis 1:26, even if we've never read Genesis 1:26. Genesis 1:26 says that God made man in his image and after his likeness to have some kind of rule over the animals and the birds and the reptiles. And we should be able to grasp this. You know, here I am, a human living among humans in this world. And wow, there's all these animals and plants and things, and I've got a kind of ability to govern this world. And that must mean that just as I am bigger than these animals, I must have been made by someone bigger than me. And there must be someone out there who's bigger than me. And by the same reasoning, he must be bigger than everything else that's made. And so it would be perfectly reasonable and very wise for someone to seek out an invisible, uncreated, good, wise, kind creator to worship him. That'd be perfectly reasonable. And in a very, very few cases, certain unchristian philosophers have actually gone many of those steps. If any of you ever get to read Plato sometime, you'll find, and Christians have found this for centuries, wow, it's almost like he was reading Bible on some of this stuff. There was some real insight there. Plato was a real genius, and he actually did have a little bit less of this foolishness in his life than many others. But you know the amazing thing? Even in his case, he approved of idolatry. It's an incredible thing. That the very best example that humanity can offer, Plato's one of the ones that I can think of, there's probably a few others, of people who have real insight into the meaning of the world and their own life and the creation around them and the skies above, deliberately choose idolatry. Okay? And what does God do when humans, who have God clearly revealed to them, deliberately choose foolishness and darkness of mind and heart by doing the opposite of Genesis 1:26? For there's a God who made us in his image to rule the fish, the birds, the animals, and the reptiles, and we forget that God, and we make images of fish and birds and animals and reptiles and give glory to these things that don't deserve glory, taking it from the one who does deserve glory. Do you see how exactly backwards this is from the way God made us? Genesis 1:26 turned on its head. There's a quip that I think will help you remember this. God made man in his image, and we've been repaying the favor ever since. We make him in our image. We make images to worship. And in so doing, we actually kind of worship ourselves because we can look at all these gods and say, oh, I made that God. Second step, the God who revealed himself in creation, we deliberately suppressed the knowledge that we had about him and plunged ourselves headlong into idolatry. Third step is, what did God do in response? Sit idly by and continue to send rain and sunshine and all sorts of benefits and blessings to his creation and just give it all away to idols? It's what idolaters would like him to do. But it's not what he's done. What he's done is actually begin inserting into the history of humanity some of his judgments that are previews of what we'll get to at the fourth step, of the full revelation of his judgment at the last day. And some of the judgments, there's different ways that God judges sin. Sometimes he does spectacular things like the flood, right? He intervenes and adds a lot of extra judgment to a situation. But there's another way that God judges, and that is by leaving his creatures to some of the natural consequences of their sin. Deliberately allowing the problems that come with sin to multiply and grow and be extended, and he's done that in a spectacular way described in Romans 1. You'll notice there's a word exchange in verse 23. We exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Then look at verse 25. We exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator. Both of those verses are talking about an exchange in worship. Creator versus creature. And then there's another exchange in verse 26. Their women exchanged natural relations for those that are against nature. And now we get into the subject of homosexuality. But I want you to see the beginning of verse 26 says that God gave them up. This is a common biblical description of one type of judgment that God brings into human history and to human life. Releasing, taking away things that would prevent the full growth of the harmful consequences of our own sin, allowing us to go places that will be harmful for us. Gave them up. So this is God's judgment. And you'll notice that there's this connection because of that word exchanged between what we did to God, exchanging the creator's glory for a creature's glory, and what God allowed us to do to ourselves. Exchanging one type of relations for another, natural for unnatural. And what I want to do is show you two ways that the sin of homosexuality, which is outlined in verses 26 and following, is especially good as an illustration of the broader pattern of human sin and divine judgment, because it is an especially close connection to the original sin of idolatry. I didn't say that very elegantly. Let me try it again. Homosexuality and idolatry are similar to each other. One in a vertical dimension, the other in a horizontal dimension. The word exchange is Paul showing this similarity. In each case, there's an exchange of something. And the similarity is actually really, really close. And we'll see it in two ways. First of all, homosexuality, like idolatry, violates the clear meaning of nature. Okay, that's the problem with idolatry. The clear witness of creation is that every creature should look to the creation and acknowledge a creator. That's the implication of Romans 1:18 and following. And in a similar way, homosexual practices are a violation of the clear meaning and witness of nature. You just have to be deliberately ignorant of the meaning of nature in order to either affirm or engage in homosexual practices. That's what Paul's saying here. You'll notice this word natural and unnatural. Some would say that these are something to do with customs. You know how we say, well, it's their second nature to do a certain thing because they're from California, right? Californians wear t-shirts all the time, something like that. I don't believe Paul is thinking on that level when he uses the word nature. He's speaking more specifically, and evidence of that is that he uses this word women and men in the passage that we are looking at here, verse 26 and 27. You'll notice women exchanged natural relations, men likewise gave up natural relations with women, and then men committing shameless acts with men. Those phrases are repeated several times, those key terms. In those, all of those cases, it's actually not the normal sort of everyday word for man and woman in Greek. It's the specific, more technical term for male and female. So, I mean, it'd be a bit weird if, oh, hello, all the females, you all look so nice today. I mean, we just don't talk like that, right? Unless we're trying to highlight something quite specific and technical. And in the same way, in Greek, you would just call men men. You wouldn't call them males, and you would call women women normally, not call them females. But Paul is using the specific and technical terms here, male and female. He's trying to get us to think about Genesis 1:26. God made us in his image. What's the very next phrase in Genesis? Male and female. Right? And just as the first half of the passage we've read is about the fact that we make God in our image, the second half of the passage is that we violate the meaning of male and female in our own life. So that's what Paul's talking about when he says nature here. He's not talking about custom or what's normal or what's socially approved or something. He's specifically talking about biological and physical nature that we can observe and see in the world around us. So that's the first similarity between homosexuality and idolatry. Both violate the clear meaning of nature. The second similarity between them is that both dishonor what ought to be honored. What's the problem with idolatry? We exchange the honor of the immortal God for the glory, or we refuse to honor God by exchanging his glory for the glory of creatures. We did not honor him or give him thanks. That's the core problem of idolatry. God is the kind of being who deserves to be honored. It is reasonable for small little creatures like us to give honor to great big creator like him. That's reasonable. Honor belongs to him. But we took it from him and dishonored him. And a similar thing goes on in homosexuality. Notice what Paul says is a problem here. God gave them up, verse 26, to dishonorable passions. Verse 24, the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. And then verse 27, committing shameless acts. Paul there doesn't mean there actually is no shame in the acts. He means the people are completely numbed to the fact that they are doing something shameful. They're shameless in the sense that they're unwilling to change their behavior, even though it's shameful. So honor and shame here is part of Paul's argument. Now, some have said that means Paul, he's just, you know, in the ancient world, there was a lot of talk about honor and, you know, society frowned on dishonorable things. And so Christians would be right to avoid dishonorable things because of the social upheaval they would cause. But now that we live in a world where honor and shame are not so important, and, you know, hey, the world around us actually honors many of these activities now, so maybe Paul's meaning has changed. But what we need to understand is that Paul's not saying, just as he wasn't saying about idolatry, the problem is that, you know, in society, people, you know, approve of true worship. And so if you don't worship God, you're not honoring him in the way that he deserves to be honored according to societal expectation. That doesn't make any sense because every society gave all of their honor to people who worship false gods, right? The issue with homosexuality then is not what society thinks is honorable. It's what types of things are actually intrinsically deserving of honor. And it is amazing to me that in the whole turmoil of different opinions on this whole subject, the clear beauty of the Christian message is lost on this point, that we are distinguished by the fact that we actually think human bodies are honorable. That's our distinguishing feature. We don't believe human bodies are to be mistreated. The wonderful thing about being a Christian, it's something I just need to impress on you, like your body is an incredible thing. It is part of what it means to be made in God's image. It's part of the dignity and glory of reflecting to the created world, including the angels, who don't have their own bodies like we do to reflect God's glory in this way, that the God who made us in his image is worthy of worship. People should look at your body and mine and say, wow, there's a God up there whose glory is reflected and refracted through this physical stuff, moving and talking and doing all these amazing things. It's amazing. And what does homosexuality do? It goes up to a female and says, don't need you, I'd rather have a male. And then it goes up to that male and says, I'm going to treat you as if you're a female. Or vice versa, or in some other combination, because, you know, these things get complicated. Right? But seriously, the basic problem is the same, no matter what, that someone is getting treated as if they were in another body than what God actually gave them. The most extreme version of this is transgender practices, where people actually will mutilate their own body in order to make it a mimicry of another kind of body. You know, we talk about sex reassignment, all that. It's nonsense. It's not sex reassignment. It's costuming at a massive personal expense, pain, suffering, and almost torture. It's a terrible travesty that in the world around us, by the way, the medical establishment is not up in arms calling out against the idea that it would be reasonable to help someone reassign their sex, so to speak, or affirm their gender, as the terminology is now. Why? Where are the doctors out in the streets protesting that they did not sign up to treat bodies as if they were meaningless pieces of meat? Your body's not a meaningless piece of meat. It is a beautiful, wonderful, absolutely significant, even eternally valuable part of the creation that God has made. You know, this building here, it's older than some of us, but we're going to outlast it. Each one of us has hands and feet and eyes that are eternal. Because God's going to raise your body one day, and he'll raise your body, not somebody else's, and he's not just going to make some random body for you. It'll be your body. And for you to take what God has imbued with such honor and to take someone else's body that God has given such honor and to treat it as if it was meaningless, whether it was male or female, is a blasphemy to high heaven. That's what that is. It's blasphemy. Because here's someone made in the image of God, and just as murder is blasphemy because it's a destruction of someone made in the image of God, a shameless, dishonorable treatment of another person's body is a kind of blasphemy because it shames and dishonors the image of someone who deserves all honor eternally. You see how significant this is? Paul is not randomly choosing this as an example because he's homophobic or something. There's a real and deep connection between the issue of homosexuality and the issue of true worship. Just by the way, that's why this is a big deal. That's why it's not optional. It's why you can't be a godly Christian. So there's these connections. Homosexuality, like idolatry, violates the clear meaning of nature, and, like idolatry, it dishonors what ought to be honored. That's the connection. Now, let's see, time. I'm going to do this quick. There are several false interpretations of this passage. I've summarized them in previous sermons, but I want to repeat them a number of times from different passages to show how the same arguments keep coming up from people who wish to evade the clear meaning of Scripture. Or whether that's their intention or not, that's the effect of their teaching. They're explaining away what is relatively clear here. So let me give you four false interpretations that are offered of Romans 1 from people who wish to affirm those who engage in homosexual practices. I just want to make you familiar with them and show you quickly why they're not correct. First of all, there are those who focus on the phrase in verse 20. Let me find it here. Oh, man. Sometimes out here my eyes just can't find the right words. Somewhere in here, there's the phrase, inflamed with lust. Verse 27, consumed with passion. The problem is I was working from one translation here, and now I'm working from another preaching. Consumed with passion in verse 27. And people will say, look, Paul's not talking about normal sexual behaviors between gay couples or something. He's talking about people who are sexually out of control. And there's either a massive like promiscuity issue, going beyond the bounds of committed relationships and having many, 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 many sexual partners, which, by the way, is a fairly normal pattern among LGBTQ people, at least the G in LGBTQ. That's a very normal pattern. That's what they think Paul is criticizing. He's not criticizing normal sexual behavior among gay couples. He's criticizing sexual behavior that's characterized by sort of extreme and out of control passion and lust. You had the Old Testament and everything, loved Jesus, and witnessed and was a missionary in ancient Greco-Roman society and was very learned and part of that culture. Okay? Do you think Paul would just skate by the issue if he thought the main problem was promiscuity or excessive lust? Do you think he wouldn't have clarified that? Right? So there's a bit of a plausibility test to apply here. It's a little bit difficult to believe that Paul wouldn't be clearer if that's what he meant. If he was, in fact, transforming received teaching on the subject among the Jews that dramatically, probably he would have said something about it more clearly. So that's one thing. The second thing is, that Paul is not saying that they are consumed with passion because of a particular feature of the behaviors that are happening. He's not looking at certain homosexuals and saying that person is practicing lust in a consuming or excessive way. He's linking consuming passion to the whole category of homosexual practices. And his point is that anyone whose sexual desires leads him to flagrantly transgress God's law and violate the meaning of creation and dishonor what ought to be honored is giving evidence that they have out of control lust. Just the very fact that someone would desire to do all of those things shows that their sexual lusts are out of control, right? So it's not a specific behavior among homosexuals where if you were to fix that, then gay couples and everything would be affirmed by Scripture. Paul's saying the whole category is evidence of consuming passion. The second bad explanation is we could call the exploitation argument. And the evidence for this argument is that in Paul's day, it was very common for homosexual relationships to be conducted between an older and wealthy man and a younger protege, sometimes like a teenage boy or a young adult boy. It's called pederasty. It's a very kind of common, well-known, sort of fashionable thing in upper-class society in ancient Greece and Rome. And it was a kind of exploitative relationship. There was a young man who needed a career boost, and one of the ways he could get that was by a sexual relationship with an older, established, wealthy patron. Now, it's exploitation. We can identify that. But the question is Paul therefore not criticizing the broader category of homosexual relationships? This is the claim. Everyone agrees that such exploitation happened, but the claim is that the only kind of relationship Paul was criticizing, not the general category of just man-male sex or woman-female sex.